Hello and welcome to Evil in the Stacks. I'm Genevieve Newman, your host for today's very special bonus episode. I'll keep our intro short this time. So for this episode, I'm interviewing Dr. Johnny Walker from Northumbria University. I'll get him to go ahead and give his full title so that I don't leave anything out. But I also want to note before we start that there is some discussion of a specific series in the Splatter comic title called Boots of the Oppressor, in which Johnny and I have a brief discussion of slavery, rape, and where the two intersect. So if that conversation isn't your kind of thing, I'll put the codes for the beginning and ending of that segment in the show notes for you, and you can go ahead and skip it. So with that, let's jump in. So, Johnny Walker, just before we get into the interview proper, would you mind going over like what your current official title or titles are, any positions you hold, anything like that, so that our audience can get an idea of who you are as a scholar?
Certainly. Well, thank you, Genevieve, for having me. So I'm Johnny Walker. I'm Associate Professor of Film and Media at Northumbria University, and currently I'm Head of Education for the Department of Arts at Northumbria as well.
So you are currently working on or finished an article?
Not quite.
Okay. A piece on, you're currently working on a piece about underground horror comics. Am I getting that right?
Correct.
Okay. So tell me something about underground horror comics, right? So are you looking specifically at the US or the UK? And what are some of the most exciting titles you've come to?
Sure. So, well, I mean, firstly, just to give you a little bit of context on the piece that I'm writing and why I'm doing it. So it's going to be, it's hopefully will be included in this mammoth Routledge companion to horror that some friends of mine are editing, including Adam Lowenstein at Pittsburgh. And I was invited to contribute to this book. And they sort of were working out what they wanted to include. And of course, you know, it's a very comprehensive volume and the chapters are very short, but it's so, and it's very comprehensive. And the thing that they wanted me to write, I politely refused because it just would have taken so much time for me to sort of gather research materials for this particular chapter. And Adam was like, well, we still like you in the book. Is there anything that you'd like to write on? And I said, yeah, I would love to write something on 1970s American horror fiction, as in novels. And he said, that's great, but somebody's already doing that. So is there anything else that you'd like to write on? And I was like, well, you tell me what there is and I'll tell you if I can do it. And he said, there's a slot on horror comics. And I said, yeah, great. I've wanted to write something on comics for ages. There's not a lot in academic terms written about horror comics in the period that I'm really interested in, i.e. the 80s into the 1990s. Yeah, I would love to do that. Because I've been over the past few years, I mean, I write mostly on British stuff, but in recent years I've done stuff on 80s American horror cinema, but like the low end stuff, like direct-to-video, shot on video. And as a fan of horror for many, many years, you know, I've consumed all horror media, including horror comics. And it just struck me that there are immense and quite obvious parallels between horror film of the 1980s and other horror media, including comics. So there are many sort of gnarly, underground, black and white horror comics from the late 1980s, which I really sort of wanted to give due academic attention to. So like titles such as, well, anthology titles such as Gore, Shriek and Splatter and Slash, as well as a number of other movie adaptations such as Leatherface, Reanimator, Demonic Toys. All of these are the sort of like unusual movie adaptations that you would not necessarily think in the 80s, or, well, you would certainly not think major comic presses would be interested in publishing. So you get this sort of boom in horror comics from hitherto unknown, really, independent publishing houses.
So this is what you're describing is actually, to my mind, a trend that we see even earlier, right? Between the anthology pieces and the kind of adaptation. So I also think of some of the earlier TV crossovers, right? And it would be super interesting. I haven't looked into it to see if comics are one of the first places we see transmedia properties, right? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I do think that, you know, when we talk about transmedia storytelling and we think about, you know, Henry Jenkins's first book and all that stuff, it does strike me that horror media is somewhat of an oversight in that book, actually. If we look to the late 80s, 1989, for example, when Charles Band, this movie mogul, establishes Full Moon Entertainment, which went on to become this independent, but with major distribution, video, straight-to-video production company. He's one of the first, or rather Full Moon is one of the first, to sort of create a relationship with a comics publisher to have their work adapted and expanded in comic book form. So there is certainly examples of that kind of crossover in the late 1980s. And I do wonder, I mean, that doesn't quite answer your question, but I do think it's an interesting question, and one that I think further research, probably not by me, but further research will uncover, because there is increasingly more work being done on horror comics, for sure, but it does tend to be more, the focus more on contemporary stuff. Aside from the pre-code and sort of the moral panic around Tales from the Crypt and EC Comics stuff on Warren Publishing, I mean, there's not a lot on Warren stuff, to be honest. But aside from that, horror comics in the period, say, between the 60s and the 2000s, for example, that it is somewhat of an oversight.
Yeah, absolutely.
Beyond sort of peripheral acknowledgement in shorter essays and stuff. So I do think, for me anyway, part of the rationale for me writing this piece on horror comics of the 80s and 90s, American horror comics of the 80s and 90s specifically, is to account for that gap and to redress the balance, but also to expand one's knowledge, or the field's knowledge, if you will, of American horror generally speaking. So, like, obviously you're a film studies scholar, I'm trained as a film scholar, and the foundations of horror studies as we now know it, you know, writing by the likes of Robin Wood and Carol Clover and so on and so forth, it's all about the 70s and the 1980s, but it's also about film, chiefly. And we might, you know, we talk of the modern American horror film, but I think it's probably time that we broadened that out to talk about modern American horror culture and looked at and to look at those other examples of media that are essentially probing the same issues as modern American horror films like Rosemary's Baby, Night of the Living Dead, and so on. And beyond that, but in different forms, and I think comics as a medium is fascinating, really, and very sort of telling, I think, of horror culture of that period, and you can sort of use comics actually as somewhat of a barometer to assess, to gauge what horror fans are into, what horror fandom means in the 1980s, who's watching what's popular, because they're very intertextual. And for that reason, I think very valuable to scholars, actually.
Do you have any kind of thoughts or ideas on the ways that a lot of these titles from the period you're working with, or even earlier, are now getting picked up in kind of a resurgence of a specific kind of horror comic. So I, part of our collection includes a lot of Red Circle comics. And that brings us to The Chilling Adventures in Sorcery with As Told by Sabrina, I think is the full title, but I could be messing that up because it's very long. So that is now being like rebooted in comic form and also had the Netflix series, right? So I wonder if any of the titles you're working with are seeing the same kind of love in the 2020s context, right?
Yeah. That's a great question, right? And the short answer to that is, generally speaking, no, they aren't. As a general rule. And I think that's fascinating because the comics that I'm interested in, so for example, there's an anthology comic, Black and White, that starts in the late 1980s, I want to say 1988, called Splatter, published by a press, North Star Comics. And it's, I mean, very, very rudimentary to begin with, but as it progresses, it becomes more sophisticated and refined and all the rest of it. But really, nobody's interested in this comic at all. It didn't sell especially well. It wasn't published very regularly, is what I'm trying to say, because the press was so small and there would be these massive months between issues and stuff. Yet it was present. Yes, it was published. And yes, it did have a readership. What is interesting is that a number of the artists, for example, and the writers that maybe cut their teeth on something like Splatter or other North Star comics have subsequently gone on to feature quite prominently in contemporary horror comics that have gone on to be adapted for television. And the most famous example, of course, is The Walking Dead. And Tim Vigil, this amazing comic book artist, was working for North Star as a freelancer. He did some strips for Splatter and of course went on to play an active role in the Walking Dead comics when they were first published. So there was certainly continuity, right, between what was happening in the late 80s, early 90s, but so few of those comics titles still exist, and they're certainly not ripe for TV adaptation. I mean, I would say though that a couple of titles like Evil Ernie is one that still materializes and is still published today. Dead World, which is the first horror zombie anthology comic or series, long running zombie series, that is still published in Caliber Comics, which published that in the 80s, still exists. But yeah, the short answer, that was a very long short answer, I appreciate, but the short answer is no, not really.
So I do, the other thing I wanted to make sure that I asked you about is among our less well-known pieces, we have, it's like two or three mm-hmm. issues that mm-hmm. Jeff Catherine Jones worked on, who is like, I don't quite know like if this is a first, but is one among the first out trans femme writers or I think artists in the horror comic space.
Wow.
So I'm wondering if there's anything that you've come across like that, where it's like, oh, by the way, we also have this incredibly important historical piece in among a medium and a genre and a type of publication that just doesn't get the attention that it really deserves, right? If you've come across anything like that.
I mean, that's a great question. I mean, this is an answer of two parts, okay? Because on the one hand, and I'm cheating really when I say this, is that I think all of this material that I'm talking about needs to be appraised, right?
Yes.
Because
yes.
All of it in some way is significant. Now, the majority of it, I would say, is not especially progressive. frankly. A lot of the stuff in the late 80s, well, the majority of it is like super hyper masculine. Like, because it's like the horror comics of this period, the late 80s at least, buy into that whole fanboy culture. There are lots of allusions to like hair metal of the 1980s, which of course was like, of course there were groundbreaking all women bands like Vixen from that period, but mostly, you know, we're talking about Motley Crue and I guess Kiss also is folded into this, and it was all about girls and drugs, hedonism, no space for political critique, as it were, certainly not progressive,
right?
Political critique. So yeah, I mean, in a nutshell, a lot of that stuff is interesting, but not especially notable in the as you were suggesting. Maybe there was something like that. However, there is a story that was published in Splatter, which is significant insofar as that it is penned by, and I want to get this guy's name right because I did want to mention it, Lamorris Richmond, who was an African-American freelance writer. And he penned, illustrate it, a series for Splatter called Boots of the Oppressor, which is set in the US pre-Civil War, and is essentially a narrative about slavery, obviously written from the perspective of an African-American man. And it's interesting that Splatter makes a big deal about this in the editorial. It's like, this is such a big deal, important moment. And I think on the face of it, it is a significant story, because essentially you see this, a woman slave comes back to haunt men who rape her, essentially, and they come back to seek vengeance on them. And it has a sort of interesting sort of progressive potential, sort of rape revenge narrative. I mean, I don't think it's 100% effective, to be honest. Like, and I think that it probably sails too close to the wind in terms of the way that it handles a lot of that content, right? But nevertheless, it's certainly a curio, because so much of that stuff published at that time was super intertextual, super 1980s. You know, characters would routinely wear like band t-shirts, like Nine Inch Nails. There's this one strip where a guy, one of his characters, wears a t-shirt which says like, Savini rules, of course, and like in reference to Tom Savini and stuff. Yeah, so like Boots of the Oppressor does not do any of that stuff, and has something to say, whether or not it's 100% effective in delivering the message that it's trying to deliver, right? It's about slavery. It's set in the past, and it's published in a comic strip and in a comic book that is otherwise super contemporary and super engaged with present day popular culture, pop culture, less so politics, right?
Right.
So, I mean, in that, to my knowledge, that strip was republished as like a sort of a graphic novel, but has been out of print for years, and is probably worth checking out.
That's, I am going to take a second to just be like super excited about this, because that blends. I mean, my dissertation research is on sexual violence, and I am fascinated that this exists, because I mean, even back to the 70s, we have the kind of beginnings of what will become the rape revenge cycle. And I would say that those films don't necessarily do the best job of handling their subject matter. in one way or another. I'm not saying that they're bad films. I just, they don't get it 100% right.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if you can, but, and to look at that and then also think about the way that we treat something like Birth of a Nation, right? If we want to go film history, that's about rape. I mean, it doesn't really get talked about in that way as much as I think it should, but The Birth of a Nation is, which is D.W. Griffith, for my non-film geek listeners, is specifically about the kind of birth of the Klan as a preventative against the rape of white women.
Indeed.
And that gets talked about a ton, right? Yeah. But this comic doesn't get that kind of critical treatment, which is absolutely fascinating because it's flipping that narrative, right? And talking about the way that specifically Black women and enslaved Black women were brutalized, right? So it's fascinating to me that that exists. And I mean, I've been doing this research for a while now and I have not come across a mention of it.
The thing is, like, it surprised me as well because I hadn't heard of it. Now, people have heard of it. There was, like, I did a little bit of research on the, well, I've done a lot of research, but at first I searched for this on the internet and there's like maybe a couple of fan forums where this is discussed. But what's fascinating to, well, the strip is very interesting. Well, just because it exists, frankly, but it's where it exists and in the context that it exists. Like, you know, so I said that a lot of these other strips are, I mean, they're not always apolitical. Some of them do have an agenda. There is a strip about neo-Nazis getting their comeuppance from a Vietnam veteran, which is like, so which is also, you know, trying to sort of probe, say something. But a lot of it, the sort of the motive, if you will, of the editors of these comics are to shock ultimately. And it's like, and a lot of the marketing that surrounds these comics, a lot of the paratextual material is akin to exploitation movie advertising. And in fact, I think I mentioned earlier, all of these are in black and white. And part of that, of course, is due to the fact that these presses aren't especially well-resourced. But another reason that's given by one of the editors is that, well, black and white resonates with contemporaneous exploitation film posters. So like the poster for Last House on the Left, for example, the US one sheet. And the majority of those posters from that period are either black and white exploitation posters, are either black and white or they're black, white and red or something, you know. Again, which speaks to the resourcefulness or the limited resources of the distributors. And so there is a sort of, a continuity between movie poster advertising of the 1970s, the modern American horror film, and the aesthetic of these comics of the late 1980s. And I suppose what's interesting about that, from my perspective, as a historian of video, this is something else I do on the side, is that. The 80s is the era of video and remediation and what Barbara Klinger would call replay culture. Horror fans are, a lot of them will be seeing for the first time in the 1980s, controversial films that were theatrically distributed in the 1970s, like Last House on the Left, like The Exorcist, like I Spit on Your Grave, even. And it sort of makes sense that the video culture of remediation of the 1980s would feed into these comics. And, you know, you mentioned the rape revenge cycle before, and I think that it probably would be fair to say that Boots of the Oppressor owes something to rape revenge exploitation cinema, spearheaded by I Spit in Your Grave, and how, I mean, I Spit in Your Grave is an interesting case, but just, you know, how the notion, the act of rape functions as right. as a cynical sort of like shock factor, to shock audiences is like a gimmick almost. Right. Boots of the Oppressor, I think, owes something to that. I don't think it's just that. And right. I'd be sort of like hesitant to sort of like flippantly dismiss it, because I do think there is an intention there.
Right.
Yeah. To say something. So I would say we'd have to be nuanced if we were talking about it.
Right.
But as an object of study, it's fascinating. And from what I've read of the comics of that period, there is nothing else like it.
That's fascinating. So I did want to, this has kind of come up, we've skirted around it a little bit, but I wanted to talk to you about the kind of crossover with music, right? Because comics are an interesting one. I mean, horror in general tends to have really interesting resonances. It sounds like what you're talking about in these particular comics is a kind of resonance with, you mentioned hair metal. I wonder if there's any kind of crossover with punk and with zines. You said the neo-Nazi thing, right? And that's a very punk kind of idea, especially in that era. So I'm just wondering, and then also punk in that era is kind of split two ways between neo-Nazis and like anti-fascist kind of ideologies. Yeah. So I'm just wondering if you have like any thoughts on the kind of resonances with music culture in horror broadly and also in horror comics.
Well, I mean, this is my wheelhouse because, I mean, I absolutely love talking about this stuff. And I've got a friend, my friend Tom Watson, who's senior lecturer at Teesside University. He writes a lot about punk and where punk intersects with horror cinema specifically. And he published a great thing recently on Green Room.
Yes.
The film Green Room.
Yes.
But yeah, certainly the allusions to music culture in these comics are overt, and they are just as overt as they are in the pages of Fangoria. And they're just as overt as they are in the pages of contemporaneous amateur fanzines like Videos and Blackest Heart Media, which I think started in the early 90s. But sure, I think that what's interesting about hair metal is, and I've written about this in relation to the novels of the British author Sean Hudson from the 1980s. What's interesting about hair metal is earlier bands of the traditional British heavy metal tradition, like Iron Maiden, for example, positioned themselves in a roundabout way as a political band, like offering political commentary. Whereas hair metal bands like Motley Crue and Dokken and all of those other bands, you know, rarely did that.
Right.
Or if they did, they did it in some sort of like half-arsed sort of like, yeah, this is a song about politics, but is it really kind of thing? And I think you see that ambivalence in the horror comics of the late 1980s, because they are less concerned with offering radical political commentary than they are with entrenching themselves within the transient pleasures of popular culture like movies. So it is very common in these comics to see a subculture being represented, like a metal subculture. So you might see like an Anthrax t-shirt, for example, Nine Inch Nails for sure. I think it tends to, at least in comics like Slash and Splatter, lean towards metal more so than it does punk. But it's interesting to see, because The Crow, which is probably one of the most famous horror comics of the, was published by Kitchen Sink, written by James O'Barr, who also incidentally was writing for North Star at the time that Splatter was published as well. That strip owes a lot to Joy Division, and post-punk culture.
Yes.
Yet James O'Barr's later stuff that he was doing for North Star, like Zeitgeist, that's one of the strips that he does. It's not post-punk. It is very much indebted to contemporaneous trends around metal.
Right.
Everybody's got MTV hair and stuff, right? So, yes, to answer your question, music for sure. Like it's everywhere. But also, it's not just hair metal, actually.
Right.
Sort of it walks a fine line because on the one hand, it's as indulgent in sex and hedonism and excess as hair metal is, but also in editorials, there might be reference to some like obscure death metal band, and it's like they'll recommend like videos and music to check out, and it'll be like some obscure band that you know only those who know will have heard of. Correct. So yeah.
That's Is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
One thing that I would say is that I think horror studies, as it is now, has a lot of catching up to do when it comes to non-screen media based examples of popular culture. And I think that horror comics of the 80s and 90s are as pivotal to the study of horror in those periods as films are, as indeed fiction is, popular paperback fiction is, and as indeed young adult fiction is too, like Point Horror, Fear Street, for example. A lot of that stuff is yet to be appraised by scholars of horror, and I think we'll only fully understand modern American horror culture when every corner is examined and we appraise all forms of horror media, because I think focusing on film squarely comes at the detriment of these other examples, which are for my money just as important and revealing of the state of horror film culture, of horror culture in the 80s and 90s.
That was fantastic. I want to thank our guest, Johnny Walker, for being with us today. And I want to thank everyone listening at home for coming on this journey with us.
Oh, thanks. No, thank you. No, I've had a lovely time and it was nice to be, it's nice to be involved because I appreciate this is like a bonus episode and this wasn't part of the schedule. So thank you for having me.
As mentioned in our last episode, Evil in the Stacks will return at the end of February with another regularly scheduled episode on comic books, horror, and archival collections. Thanks. Have a good day.